ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Andy Finn Show. I'm Andy Finn, the Finn Man, and for the next hour, you're in Finland. And today is Monday, March 17th, and that has a nice ring to it, because it was on this day in 461. That's correct, the year 461, or Aught 461, as we used to call it, that Bishop Patrick died. And Ireland celebrates this day in his honor to this day, St. Patrick's Day. So for those of you who are Irish or just wish you were Irish, happy St. Patrick's Day. I'm 50% Irish. I was born half German and half Irish. My father's name, Finn, is quite Irish. My ancestors came from County Cork in Ireland, and it's a beautiful country. I don't know if you heard the one about the competition between Germany and Britain and Ireland, but they've had this friendly competition going among their scientists for quite some time. And German scientists, about 10 years ago, dug about 50 meters underground when they were putting up a building, and they discovered these small pieces of copper. And after they studied them for a while, they came out and announced that the ancient Germans, 2,000 years ago, had a nationwide telephone network. That's what they figured the copper was for. Well, it shocked the scientific world, of course. And not to be outdone, the British government said, well, look, we are the ultimate discoverers of antiquities, and we're not that easily impressed. So their scientists dug down twice as far. They dug down 100 meters, and they found small pieces of glass. And so they announced that 10,000 years ago, the ancient Brits had a nationwide fiber network and showed up the Germans. Well, the Irish, not to be outdone, their scientists were outraged. So they dug down 150 meters, and they found absolutely nothing. So the scientific paper that they published said the Irish 50,000 years ago had a cellular telephone network. You might have to think about that one. Anyway, it is March 17th, and a lot of interesting things happen on this date. Not simply that it's St. Paddy's Day, which it is. It's also the birthday of John Sebastian, one of my favorite songwriters, the main songwriter for the Lovin' Spoonful. He also wrote, he has the distinction of being one of the few folk rock musicians or well-known musicians who wrote not one, but two theme songs for hit television shows. So he wrote, I'm not sure what the second one is. He wrote Welcome Back, Kotter. And I was thinking he wrote Monk, but no, that's Randy Newman. I think Randy Newman's the one that wrote two. Anyway, it's not Randy Newman's birthday, so let me change the subject. It's also Paul Kantner's birthday. And if you don't recognize that name, he was in Jefferson Airplane and Jefferson Starship. Anyway, let's move on. We got a couple of big issues tonight to tackle. One is Jeremiah Wright, Obama's preacher. The whole country seems, well, the whole right wing seems up in arms about that, and some moderates seem up in arms. We're going to discuss that tonight in some detail. Also, the fifth anniversary of the Iraq War starts Wednesday. It was 5 years ago today that George W. Bush gave Saddam Hussein 48 hours to get out of town. And he wasn't kidding. And Saddam, he could have actually taken a deal at that point and gotten out of town. And I think what his general was quoted as saying is, I think you're bluffing. No, you weren't bluffing. Anyway, before we get to that, we always start with something a little bit lighter, and do I have something light for you? The other thing that happens right around March 17th every stinking year is bracketology. And if you don't know that term, you are not that interested in hearing a sports segment, but this won't be a typical sports segment. Mine usually aren't. So the NCAA tournament selection team made their decisions yesterday, and the field of 65 teams has come out. I will make several comments about that, and then I'm going to give you a lowdown on a general way to pick teams. Like if you have a a pool at school, at work or school, and you don't really, you aren't much of a fan, but you'd like to play along, but you never know who to pick, I have a couple of foolproof clues for you. So hold on for that. Let me just say one other thing, though. Everybody talks about the NCAA tournament being such a perfect tournament, and they complain about the BCS and college football and say they don't crown the national champion. You know, you don't really have the best team winning. You don't have the best team winning the NCAA tournament either. You have to win six straight games to win this tournament. There's a fair amount of luck involved. And you can a great team gets knocked off anywhere in there who should have been in the Final Four, and they're not. In football, because they don't play as many games, they're just trying to get a matchup of the final two these days. And they'd like, some people would say, well, we should have a four-team tournament. But then only four teams would get a shot at the national championship. And frankly, that's about how it ought to be. That is, you don't really want to believe that the 20th best team in the country should have a shot at the national championship, since they're not a national championship team. Now, people say, well, by definition, if you win six in a row, you're the national champion team. That's true, according to the current rules. That's the problem, is that we don't crown the actual national champion. And I'm okay with it. I'm not really suggesting they'll ever change the tournament. They won't. Too many people like it the way it is. They like it when a George Mason gets in, or as American University did this year for the first time ever. Congratulations, American. People like it when the underdogs get in. They like it when the underdogs win, unless the underdog beats your team. The tournament starts Thursday, so you have until Thursday morning to get your picks in. All I'm saying about the tournament is that if they really cared about choosing the true national champion, they would set up a double elimination tournament. That is, you can lose one game and you're still in it. When you lose two, you're out. And then you'd have something, because then you would be in a situation where a great team could have an off night. They could have an injured player one night. They could run into a really hot shooting team, and instead of losing by 1 point in overtime and being bounced, they have a chance to come back and see what they're made of. And in that situation, you'd only take the top eight teams, or maybe the top 16 teams, and you'd be allowed to lose twice before you were eliminated. Now, there'd be logistical problems with that, and a lot of teams would get left out. But you'd have a much better chance that the best team in the country would rise to the top than we do under the current format. I say this every year. Nobody's ever going to do anything about it. But I am tired of everybody saying that the football situation is so flawed and the basketball situation is perfect. Nothing's perfect, is my point. So if you do have a bracket, though, and you're thinking of filling it out, I want to give you a couple of tips. I've been doing brackets for better than 20 years. And over the years, I've run a number of tournaments. I haven't run one in more than 10 years, but I used to run one when I was in the corporate world, and it got pretty big. It got to the point I couldn't really handle it. And this was before we had the internet and all these internet-based ones you could look at. So this was, you fill out your picks, we make a Xerox copy and put them up on the wall, and then you have to score them after every round by hand, with the yellow highlight marker to see which games you won and add up the scores and check each other's work and all of that. Anyway, Dan Steinberg in the Washington Post today has a set of hints for how to fill out a bracket if you don't know what else to do, or just even if you do know. And it's really good advice. Some of it is advice I've given before, and so I'm going to read a little bit of it. Some of it is things that I hadn't thought of. And he leaves out a couple of things that I do think of. The first thing he says is ignore the 5-12 rule. Well, of course, the number one seed is against the number 16 seed, two against 15. So the 12th seed plays the fifth seed. And he's saying that people always want to pick 1-12 seed to beat a 5 seed, and he says it rarely happens. He's right. That brings us to a more general rule, and he sort of covers that in Rule 2, Hate Cinderella. That is, if you pick a Cinderella team, a team that is a 12 seed or 11 or even a 6-7 seed to go all the way, chances are that part of your bracket's going to get ruined and you're not going to score a lot of points. Keep in mind how this works. There are 32 games in the first round because there are 4 regions, 16 teams in each region, total of 64 teams. Forget the 65th team that for the play-in game. That's the dumbest thing ever. You can ignore that for now. You have 32 games the first weekend, and then 16 after that. But basically, the first round there's 32 games, the second round there's 16 games, the third round there's 8, et cetera, et cetera. So, in the first weekend here, there's 32 games. They're worth 1 point apiece. The first round is worth 1 point apiece in most pools. The second round is 2 points, 3 points, 4 points, until you get to the final four. And that second last game, the two second last games are each worth 5 points, and the final game's worth 6 points. That's the way most brackets do it. So it's weighed heavily, and it's a mistake to pick upsets too early. And that's exactly Dan Steinberg's point. So if you are filling out a bracket, you may want to do the safe thing. What I've seen people do before is pick the favorite in each case. Even the 8-9 games, where it's pretty balanced, pretty equal, always pick the higher seed. The 8 seed is higher in this case, of course. The 1 seed's higher than the 16. Always pick the higher seed, and chances are you'll do just fine. That's the theory. The problem is, a lot of people in your pool, if you're in a big pool, there'll be a dozen people will choose that. Now, the final four, they're all number one seeds, so you'd still have to make a decision. The point is, a lot of people could tie if you all pick exactly the same teams. So the question is, how do you vary from the favorites, and when do you pick upsets? And that's what Steinberg talks about in his column. He says, look to the power conferences for an upset. So you don't look to the mid-majors like the Colonial Athletic Association or George Mason, or you don't look to American to get the upset. You take Kentucky, that let's say, and there, I don't know, I'd take Kentucky this year, but you know if you listen to my show that Kentucky's near and dear to my heart because I used to teach there. And Kentucky's, I think, 11 seed this year, and so they're up against a 6 seed. And you know, a solid team from the SEC like Kentucky, they went 12-4 in the SEC. Although they're not having a great year, they could beat a 6 seed. Another 11 or 12 or 13 is in a different ballgame. So look to the power conferences for an upset was Steinberg's third piece of advice. His fourth one was pick the upsets in the second weekend. He's saying don't bother trying to pick upsets in the first round. Part of the reason is that you aren't going to be able to guess which. There'll be a few upsets, but it's hard to guess which ones. The second thing is, once you eliminate a team, if that team wins two or three games, you've lost all those points. So I think that's why he says pick them in the second round. The fifth piece of advice, he says, avoid the favorite to win it all. What he's saying is, if you're in a big pool with a lot of people playing, a lot of people will pick the favorite. So even if you were to win, you'd probably be tied with a lot of different people, and you won't win very much money, assuming it's a money pool. Whereas if you pick somebody who's not quite the favorite, or somebody you have an inkling about, a 2 seed to win it all, you have a much better chance of coming out on top if you are right about that final team. His sixth piece of advice is that pedigree matters. Well, what he means by that is a team that's been there already will have a better shot. Normally Duke's a good bet, even if when it's a down year for them. I don't think Duke is that strong this year, but that's why I mentioned Kentucky. It has pedigree. It has a tradition of winning at the tournament. It knows how to win, as people say. His seventh piece of advice was lock in one big conference. And this wasn't something I thought much about. He basically says, once you pick your national champion, let's say you decide you want to go with UCLA. He said, then what you're saying is you believe that out of all this talent, UCLA is the top team. Well, look at their conference then, because in the past few years, the team that wins it all, their conference does very well in the tournament. So by that logic, if you are right about your team, then you should be right about the whole conference. So when all other things are equal and you're at a toss-up, pick the other teams from your winning team's conference to win their games up to a certain point. You wouldn't pick them when they're they're heavy underdog. That was an interesting piece of advice. My general rule is similar to that, and that is never bet against the ACC. The ACC has a tremendous record over the last 10 to 20 years, a little less impressive the last 2 or 3 years, and some years they only have 3 or 4 teams in lately, unlike the other power conferences that have up to 6 teams in. But the bottom line is you don't go wrong picking power teams from power conferences. So I still like my rule a little better than his, go with the ACC. But I think it's interesting, and so I may try his rule this year. Anyway, that's it. Congratulations to the local teams that made it in. I mentioned American already. I mentioned George Mason. And the other one is Georgetown, and Georgetown's a number 2 seed. So Georgetown has a realistic shot to win this whole thing. I'm not sure they're strong enough to win it all, But they're in the region with Kansas, so if they were to get all the way to the finals of the Midwest Regional in Detroit on March 30th, it'll be Kansas against Georgetown. And, of course, there are plenty of upsets that can happen before then, but we aren't real sure of any of these games, naturally. And then, of course, there is my team, George Mason, where I currently teach. They play Notre Dame in the first round on Thursday evening. It's like at about 10 p.m. And so Notre Dame's a 5 seed. You know, they have to hit from the outside to win games. If they have an off night, Mason could actually beat them, which would be kind of cool. And then they play the winner of Washington State Winthrop. So Mason could win a game or two. I'm hopeful, actually. We shall see. In any case, enough about basketball, because the world of basketball is not quite what you tuned in for tonight, is it? The Andy Finn Show will be back with what you tuned in for right after this.
Greetings, sensationalists from across the fruity plains.
You're listening to The Andy Finn Show.
The smooth talk of the town.
Cool. We are back on The Andy Finn Show, and today is the 17th of March, St. Paddy's Day. And did you know that on this day in 1969, Golda Meir was sworn in as the premier of Israel, the first woman to lead Israel? And I suppose the last. There hasn't been one since. But she was one tough Dominican, as Walking Underwear used to say. Joaquin Andujar of the St. Louis Cardinals used to say he was one tough Dominican. She was just a tough leader. That's why they elected her. And it was the day in 1970 that the U.S. Army charged 14 officers with suppressing the facts in the My Lai massacre. Not a happy prospect, but a happier prospect is that today is also the birthday of Shemp Howard. Now, if you don't remember who we're talking about here, this is Mo Howard's brother. Remember Curly, Larry, and Mo? Well, when Curly left us, Shemp took over. He was never as good as Curly. You can't really top Curly, but there we are. All right, we are going to move on, and we are going to move on to a serious, serious discussion of Jeremiah. And if you don't know who we're talking about here, Jeremiah is Jeremiah Wright, Barack Obama's preacher. He's gotten Barack in all kinds of hot water this week, the last couple weeks, because he is a traditional black preacher. Not fire and brimstone, but a lot of energy, a lot of anger at times. In some cases, anger over the plight of the black man, anger at what white America has done to the black man. But he motivates. He inspires. Obama says he led him to Jesus. Who am I to question that? But there, he said some pretty strange and inflammatory things. And we're going to cover some of them today. And that will allow us to have a larger understanding, take his comments in a larger context. So I'm not saying I'm going to explain away his comments, but I'm going to give you some context. You know, when you tune in Fox News and Sean Hannity or Bill O'Reilly plays these clips, they have no interest in understanding what's behind what this guy says. All right. They're just interested in using it against the Democrats and using it against Barack Obama and inspiring outrage in their audience. I know that you didn't tune in to be fed the kind of pablum that they feed their audience. So we're going to talk a bit about where he's going with his critique and why he's going there. So we're going to start here with a little bit of Jeremiah that you might have heard before.
11 on itself.
Jeremiah was a bullfrog.
Whoops.
Was a good friend of mine.
That's not the right Jeremiah.
Never understood a single word he said, but I helped him a drink.
That's not Jeremiah Wright. That's Jeremiah Bullfrog. That's Three Dog Night from about 1970. Okay. Well, there we are. So let's talk Jeremiah Wright. Here is a cut from Barack Obama's preacher in which he explains why Barack is a better candidate than Hillary. And I'll warn you, the N-word is coming, but It's him saying it, not me.
It just came to me within the past few weeks, y'all, why so many folk are hating on Barack Obama. He doesn't fit the model. He ain't white, he ain't rich, and he ain't privileged. Hillary fits the mold. Europeans fit the mold. Giuliani fits the mold. Rich white men fit the mold. Hillary.
Okay, so this was from a summer ago when Giuliani was still in the race. I think it was about a summer ago that this was said. In any case, I guess I should go on to the next clip because he didn't get to the. I didn't let him get to the part that was there to be played. Let's go on to the next part.
The government gives them the drugs, builds bigger prisons, passes a three-strike law, and then wants us to sing God Bless America? No, no, no. Not God Bless America. God damn America. That's in the Bible for killing innocent people. God damn America for treating our citizens as less than human.
Okay, so, yes, you did hear him correctly. He said, God damn America. It's in the Bible for... And then he lists a litany of sins. So let me try and put a little that in a little bit of context. Of course, I'm not trying to defend what he said in that I disagree with it. I don't think a preacher ought to be using the expression God damn. Okay. But I do want to explain where he's coming from because I think I know where he's coming from. All right. Basically, if you go back to Jeremiah in the Old Testament, okay, and you go back to the prophetic voice, as it's called by Bible scholars and theologians. All right, basically, the job of the prophets was to call the people to account and to call the country to account. Jewish leaders were excoriated by prophets in the Old Testament, right, who said that the people weren't living right. And what Jeremiah Wright is saying when he says, God damn America, is basically, God will damn America for its behavior. Now, you could say it more pleasantly, for example, if you take a King James translation of the Gospel of Luke in the 6th chapter, the 24th verse, it reads, but woe unto you that are rich. Okay? Now, that's... doesn't really shock our ears. Woe unto you that are rich, okay? And Fox News isn't going to play it if a preacher says, woe unto you that are rich, all right? But there are other translations of that, okay? The Scholar's Translation of, that is another version of the Bible, of that same passage, okay, goes like this. Not, but woe unto you that are rich. Damn you rich. You already have your compensation. Damn you who are well fed, you will know hunger. Damn you who laugh now, you will weep and grieve. Damn you when everybody speaks well of you. That's just a different translation of, but woe unto you. Right? So I can imagine that when Jeremiah Wright says, God damn America for treating our citizens as less than human, he's saying, woe unto you, God will damn America for treating our citizens, right? That God will damn America as long as she acts like she is God and she is supreme, and he says that's what we're doing. Now, you can disagree with his critique. You can say his language is too harsh. But you also need to understand the context. If you've never been in a black church, I recommend you go some Sunday. Pick a church in an inner city area. You'll be able to figure out which ones are okay to go to by just looking up on the web and talking to people. All right, ones that have a powerful preacher, ones that preach a form of liberation theology. All right, you can't keep people coming to church if you aren't speaking their language. When you see the audience in the back of some of Jeremiah Wright's congregations, they jump up and slap five with each other when they agree with something he says. They roar with approval. They clap. They stand up and shout or stand up and clap in the middle of the sermon. You know, I never saw that in any white church I was ever in, and I went to a lot of services in my lifetime. It's just a very different atmosphere. And so his intention is to rile the people. On a Sunday morning, if you want to get their attention, you don't say, woe unto you. You say, damn. So again, I think it's a mistake to be using the language he's using. But what I don't see from the other side, from either side, is any attempt to understand the context for this. All right? Instead, they want to use it against Obama. And of course, these are not Obama's remarks. Now, Obama can't come out and say, let me explain to you what my preacher's doing, or what my previous preacher is doing. The man has now retired from Barack Obama's church in Chicago. Right? Instead, he's just distanced himself from these remarks, and rightly so. But I'm not a politician, so I can afford to say, look, there's a context here that you should probably try and understand. And when we come back, we'll talk a little more about what all that means and why we should care about this.